A look now in Washington, D.C. In late November of 2014, President Barack Obama, frustrated with Congress's inability to pass substantial immigration reform, decided he would just circumvent the partisan deadlocked Congress and issue his own order, a move he defended at the time.
The actions I'm taking are not only lawful, they're the kinds of actions taken by every single Republican president and every single Democratic president for the past half century.
But the Supreme Court on Thursday, in a split 4-4 decision, effectively deferring to a lower Texas court's ruling, blocked Obama's plan. As a result, approximately 5 million unauthorized immigrants who are parents of legal citizens or permanent residents will now be at risk of deportation. House Speaker Paul Ryan says the court voted for legal sanity and to restrain the White House.
This is a win for the Constitution. It's a win for Congress. And it's a win in our fight to restore the separation of powers. Presidents don't write laws. Congress writes laws.
Did President Obama overstep his power? With me now to discuss the broader precedence of this ruling is Eric Citron, partner at Goldstein & Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Alina Kagan, and a guest contributor to the SCOTUS blog. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So is this about separation of powers or is this about immigration?
Folks would say it's about both. The immediate effect of the case is limited to President Obama's expanded immigration program for Dreamers and for their families. But the principles that the challengers were invoking have to do with the limits of the president's ability to act without Congress in achieving changes to immigration law.
In the opinion that now, I guess, comes from the circuit court, since it was a 4-4 decision, the principle here is that any money spent on any program requires congressional authorization. And so therefore, because presumably some money was spent to operate whatever it was that the president wanted to accomplish in the executive order, it did not have approval. Is that right?
Well, I think the issue is, in order to get into court and to challenge the administration's action, Texas had to show that it suffered some concrete injury. And Texas's argument was that it was having to pay money out to create driver's licenses for people covered by the program, and that loss of money constituted a concrete injury that gave them a right to be in court. I think there's a kind of odd mismatch between that injury and the set of merits arguments that Texas was making about why the program was unlawful. But that's what kept them there, that loss of money. And so that's what entitled the states to have a lawsuit in the first place.
Which means that according to the separation of powers principles, the president can't do something unilaterally that would cause the states to have to spend money. And if they go to court to reverse it, you know, the whole White House program gets thrown out. It's not a balancing of the cost of driver's license versus the hardship of immigrants, right?
Right, exactly. This loss of money that Texas suffered was just the hook that allowed them to stay in court, and then they can make their arguments about whether or not the president is allowed to act unilaterally in this area. The Fifth Circuit said that the president could not do so. The Supreme Court technically affirms that judgment in deciding the case 4-4, but that has no precedential effect. It's not like the Supreme Court has voted in favor of that outcome or opinion. That opinion will continue to control the case in the Fifth Circuit, but if it ever comes back to the Supreme Court, this issue or even this case, the court would be free to reconsider what the Fifth Circuit has said.
Although it does appear that both the Supreme Court and a number of circuit courts have expressed a strong preference that Congress take up this matter and resolve immigration, and that there not be this policy by fiat coming out of the White House, whatever they think about separation of powers. Would you agree with that?
I will say this. I think the Constitution is set up so that the fundamental first crack at policy lies with Congress, who passes the laws, and the president, who either signs or doesn't sign them into law, with the veto power. And the options, the range of policy options that are available to Congress, vastly outnumber what the president is allowed to do. Now, the president is our prosecutor in chief, and since immigration is essentially a choice about where to focus prosecutorial resources and whom to deport and when, the president does have a lot of flexibility in putting that law into effect. But there's a whole vast array of regulatory and legal issues that surround immigration, and it is far better, I think no one would dispute, for Congress to sort them out than for the president to take what actions he can in his discretion.
Finally, you know, stepping way back here, if we look at the beginning of the Bush 43 administration up until now, many would argue that there's been a fairly steady course of growth in executive power on the national security front, predominantly in the Bush administration and perhaps in other places in the Obama administration. Would you say this vote and maybe some others that go along with it might signal that the pendulum is about to swing in the other direction, or is this just a one-off?
I think there's definitely a sense in which the Bush administration expanded the role of the presidency, especially in international affairs and defense spaces. And the Democrats, thinking, well, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, have expanded the power of the presidency in domestic affairs. And the optimist would say, well, you know, having faced down that expanded power, both sides have recognized that it ought to have its limits. The cynic would say, no, the fundamental principle here is this is only okay when my side is in power and not when yours is. And I think there is, it just remains to be seen which direction that ends up going.
Eric Citron is a partner at Goldstein and Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan and a guest contributor to the irreplaceable SCOTUS blog. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.